Okay, good morning. Is the microphone on? Yeah. I would like to speak about mechanochemical feedback loops in a process in early silverfish development, which is called PIBELE. I apologize, I think the aspect ratio is not entirely right on the screen here. Just to give you a little bit of introduction into mechanochemical feedback loops, and probably all of you have heard about it. What we're looking at mechanochemical feedback loops is essentially the interaction between mechanical instability and biochemical instability. On the left side, you have an activator and inhibitor. If there's mutual inhibition between the activator and inhibitor, this leads to segregation of these two components. Likewise, if you have an actomizer inside the skeleton and there's an instability within the actomizer inside the skeleton, this leads to the localized distribution of the actomizer inside the skeleton. As a consequence of it, you get flows of actomizing. If you take then these two instabilities together, the biochemical instability and mechanical instability, you end up with a system where you have feedbacks which lead to, for instance, polarization of cells during cell migration. Okay, we are trying to understand early morphogenesis in silverfish. I give you a couple of processes we have been looking at over the last perhaps 15, 16, 17, 18 years now. We have been interested in fourth generation, and I will talk about, if I have time, I will talk about one process where actomizing flows lead to the segregation of ooplasmin and York granules within the silverfish oocyte. This is really before morphogenesis sets in. What you have is process, and I think this is a movie, where you can see that all the ooplasmin flows up, accumulates at the animal hemisphere of the oocyte, and all the York granules ending up in the opposite side. It's a segregation of ooplasmin and York granules, and this is something we would like to speak about. I will not speak about force transmission imbalance, and here we're looking at a process which is typically, we have been doing quite a bit of work on a process which is called doming, where you see that the blastoderm begins to spread over the York cell. This is a very big York cell of the silverfish, and you can see that the York cell apparently sort of moves into the blastoderm, but in fact, what is happening here is that the blastoderm starts to spread around the York cell. This is a process which relies on different force-generating mechanisms. One is that the surface cells, which you can't see really in this image here, this is a flat epithelial cell layer, the enveloping layer. There's active spreading of the surface layer. This leads to a reduction of surface tension. There's active radial intercalation of deep cells. These are the cells which you can see here. They intercalate along the radial axis, and by doing this actively, you generate again a force which thins this layer and contributes to the spreading. The last process, which is quite important, there is a very large, and I will talk about that, there's a very large actomizing band within the York cell. This actomizing band constricts, and by constricting, it pulls on the margin of this tissue here and pulls it upwards. Okay. The third sort of larger process we have been interested in is mechanosensation in a very broad sense of the term mechanosensation. We have been, for instance, and this is just one example, and I will talk about perhaps another example a little later. We have been looking here at the influence of planar tension within an epithelial cell layer. Again, we are looking here at the EBL, the surface epithelium here. This is one epithelial cell layer which is about to divide, and the mitotic spindle is indicated here with a white bar. We want to know if changes in planar tension within the EBL has an influence on the orientation of this mitotic spindle. What we did is, we induced an ectopic tension axis within the EBL by ablating a few cells up here and here, and then you get a tension axis which is orthogonal to the original orientation of the mitotic spindle. You can see that mitotic spindle finds this new ectopic main tension axis within the tissue, within the plane of the tissue. There are multiple mechanisms you can involve in that, and I'm not going in any details here. Okay. The first process I would speak about is PIBELE, and I mentioned already this actomizing, large actomizing ring-like structure. The process we're looking at is shown here. You see that the EBL spreads over the York cell, and this is an actomizing band, a very large actomizing band, and apparently it constricts. This is actin and pulls on the margin of the EBL and pulls it over the York cell. This is a process we got interested now 6, 7 years ago. Initially, we did that in a collaboration with Stefan Grill, and Guillaume Salbru, and I show you a few of these older data where we ask how would force being generated within the yolk cell in this actomyosin ring, and how would force generation within the yolk cell then generate a pulling force on the margin of the EBL and pose it onward. And just to give you a little introduction here into the anatomy of the process, this is the castellating embryo, and you can see what I showed you here are the surface epithelial cells, below are the deep cells, and then the surface epithelial cell, the EBL, makes contact at the leading edge with the yolk cell. And the yolk cell is not just a passive substrate on which the EBL and the deep cells are moving on, but it has a thin layer of cytoplasm on the outside, which is called the yolk syncytial layer, YSL, and the thin layer of cytoplasm contains all cytoskeletal elements you're typically used to if you're looking at other cells. So it has actin, myosin, microtubules, intermediate filaments, actually keratins are in there. And what we noted very much at the beginning when we looked at this process is that actomyosin accumulates in this ring-like structure right within the YSL at the point where the EBL makes contact with the YSL. So there is apparently a band-like structure of actomyosin. And what we wanted to know is how would this band-like structure of actomyosin generate a pulling force, pulling on the margin and pose it on. One of the processes which is sort of, you know, intuitively clear is once this band moves over the equator and just constricts around its circumference, it will exert a pulling force on the margin and will pull it on. But we also want to know how would this actomyosin band possibly allow the EBL to move over the equator before it actually can activate this cable constriction motor. And what we noted, and this again is work together with Stefan, we did, we noted when we looked at the actomyosin band that there is flow of actin and myosin within this band along the width of the band, and this flow, I think it's just looping this movie, you can see the flow is directed opposite to the movement of the EBL downwards. Right? So we have a retrograde flow of actin and myosin. And this flow of actin and myosin depends on contraction of this actomyosin band along its width. And the actomyosin band is coupled at the leading edge here via junctional complexes, and I will talk about that. And it's free on the other end, and once you constrict it, then along its width, it flows in the direction where it's coupled. Oh, this movie is just jumping because we stitched together different movies, so this is not real. It's actually a smooth process, but we have stitched together different time-lapse movies. So it seems to be a stepwise process, but it's not stepwise, it's actually continuous. This is an artifact of... it's been noted a few times already. So how would the flow, or potentially the flow of this actomyosin contribute to a pulling force? Yep.
What's the mechanical connection between the EBL cells and this actomyosin?
I will talk about that for the next half hour. Hold on. So what we ended up with as a force generating process, and I'm just putting that in here as an introduction. One is the cable constriction motor. That's the one which, you know, we thought from the beginning on would act, and that is simply assuming that this actomyosin band constricts around the circumference. Once it moves over the equator, it cups the spherical geometry of the yolk cell and can pull on the margin of the EBL and can pull it downwards. So that's one of the processes. The other process which we then based on this observation that there's really a flow of actin and myosin within the band is a flow friction motor. You have retrograde flow of actomyosin, and once this flow of actomyosin is resisted by some friction to adjacent structures within the yolk cell, this could be yolk granules, anything you imagine, then this would generate a pulling force on the margin and would pull it downwards. I'll give you one example which exemplifies that the flow friction motor is presumably a meaningful motor activity. And this is, if you put embryos in spatial confinement, in this case we put it into this hourglass shape here, then you actually can then watch if a pibli is still progressing, and if it would be only the cable constriction motor, you could imagine that it all goes fine up to this point here, and then it wouldn't work anymore, right? But if you actually look at these embryos, you can see that they are pibilizing completely fine, and there's actually no slowing down once they are going up again. So that indicates that the cable constriction motor as such is probably not the only force generating process. There must be other processes which could likely be the flow friction process which allows the EBL to cover the yolk cell.
Sorry.
Yep.
To go back, I'm confused why your title there says it's dispensable. Is it actually fully dispensable, or is it it's that in conjunction with the friction?
In the case when it has to move, when it has to move upwards again, I would argue that the kelp constriction motor is not required because it's ineffective, right? I mean, it would actually pull it in the opposite direction. So it is dispensable because another motor activity can take over at this point and can substitute for it. It doesn't mean it's not active. I mean, it could still contribute to EVR fibrillary movements, but if you take it away, it still happens. So there's a compensatory mechanism which can kick in. But that doesn't mean that the compensatory mechanism is the only mechanism. Okay, so what I actually would like to talk about is then the question which has been asked already. How is the actomizing ring-like structure transferring the pulling force to the EVR margin? And so there must be junctional complexes right at this point here. And we were asking, what are the junctions which are transmitting the force? If you think about junctions and transmitting force, you think about adherence junctions, presumably. And that's what we did at the beginning, and we were starting to look at E-catenin, beta-catenin, and alpha-catenin, vinculin, you name it all, components of adherence junctions. And what we found is that these junctional components do accumulate, indeed, they are present at the leading edge. Unfortunately, I don't have an example in here. But if you look at the amount of adherence junction components, the ether go down, as you can see with E-catenin as a function of time during epiphyly, so during the process of EVL moving downwards. Or they're staying constant if you're looking at other components like beta-catenin and alpha-catenin. So the amount doesn't seem to be, there's no scaling with the amount of adherence junctions and the amount of actomizing, as you can see, which is accumulating as a function of time during epiphyly. I should have said that first. What you see is typically that the actomizing ring becomes more condensed and visible as a function of time during epiphyly. And if you compare then this accumulation of actomizing with the amount of adherence junction components, there's no correlation with it. But if you, and that was quite interesting, if you then look at tight junction components, in particular at one component, zona occludens 1, which is an adhesion adapter of the tight junction complex, then the amount of SO1 at the leading edge appear to scale with the amount of actomizing you have there. And that sort of indicates that tight junctions seem to be potentially, or you know, it points at the possibility that tight junctions are mechanosensitive because there's a scaling with the amount of actomizing accumulation and presumably tension and perhaps flows, and I'm coming to this closer. So we got interested in that to see if tight junctions might interact with the actomizing substrate. Yeah.
So do we have cloudings here? So what's the membrane out?
Yeah. Perhaps I talk a little bit later about cloudings and occludings. I mean, in short, cloudings and occludings are not accumulating like cetoproteins. So occludens proteins, cingulines, all the adhesion adapters seem to scale with the actomizing accumulation in the visor. The adhesion receptors associated with tight junctions like occludens and cloudings, there's no scaling. And I will tell you why we think so. Okay, so the first thing we ask is, and that's sort of a more trivial question, is if tight junctions have any influence on the accumulation of actomizing on ring formation. And there's loads of evidence that different tight junction components, and particularly SO proteins, can actually activate Rho A and can trigger myosin phosphorylation and actomyosin contraction and actin polymerization, actually. And they can couple directly to the actin cytoskeleton. We just wanted to know if you can generate a genetic condition where we interfere with tight junction formation and see if that would have any influence on the ring formation within the visor. In zebrafish nowadays, morpholinos are not enough anymore. So you have to generate compound mutants, which is a little more complicated. If you know, in zebrafish, you have loads of different components of SO proteins. In fact, you have 5 different SO proteins. So we started to generate loads of compound mutants. We ended up with one interesting compound mutant, which is an internal zygotic mutant for SO1B and SO3. And in this double maternal zygotic mutant, what we found is that epiphyly is delayed. So you have a problem in EVR moving downwards. It's a delay, which is approximately 1 hour. And we did loads of experiments to see if morpholinos can phenocopy the mutant phenotype, if you can rescue the mutant phenotype, you can rescue the morpholino phenotype, and so on. And it seems to be all specific. So we ended up with one condition where interference with tight junctions formation or with the expression of certain tight junction components had an effect on EVL epiphany movements. Interestingly, for everyone who's looking into mutant, that seems to be a topic which comes up now. There's compensatory upregulation of other SOP proteins in the double mutant. If you generate this double mutant, then other components, other SOP proteins are in compensatory upregulated, and that explains why the phenotype is relatively mild you're looking at here. Ideally, you would generate a quintuple mutant, I think, for all five maternal cell, but that's a little complicated. So we just thought we are focusing on the maternal psychotic SO1V3 because it had a phenotype. The first thing we want to know is if interfering with the accumulation of these SO proteins, tight junction formation, would that have an effect on actomyosin? And what we found is that indeed, if you're looking at myosin 2 localization, GP localization in the mice, you see that this is clearly reduced, and this is a quantification of it. And if you look then at the flow, the retrograde flow of actomyosin within the YSL, this seems to be affected as well. So that sort of indicates that once you are interfering with tight junction formation, you affect the accumulation of actomyosin and the formation of this actomyosin ring-like structure and the flows within the YSL as well. So that's what we, you know, for this part, what we, and you know, that's perhaps the least surprising part, we sort of just, you know, confirm that tight junctions have actually an effect on actomyosin, which, you know, has been demonstrated in many other instances as well. And this presumably goes by effects on rho A and rho GEF activating rho A and then leading to myosin 2 phosphorylation and actin polymerization. But what we're more interested in, and what is perhaps, you know, has not yet been very clearly demonstrated, if there's actually a feedback of the actomyosin ring on the accumulation of SO proteins and junction formation. So that would indicate that tight junctions might be mechanosensitive, and the coincidence of the accumulation of these ZO components with the accumulation of actomyosin indicated that there might be some crosstalk.
Carl Philip?
Yep.
Do you have an idea whether ZO1 is required specifically in the EVL or in the yolk cell?
Yeah. What you can do is, if you believe that your morpholinos are specific, you can inject morpholinos only in the yolk cell and mm-hmm. knock it down specifically within the YSL, interfere specifically with the junction between EVL and YSL without interfering with any other functions in deep cells and EVL cells, mm-hmm. and you get exactly the same phenotype typically as you see. But that requires that you validate your morpholino and so on and so forth. So, but, you know, that's what we did with mutant then. Okay, so the experiment, what we wanted to see is if you're interfering with actomyosin specifically within the YSL, would, you know, that have an effect on the accumulation of ZO proteins and tight junction formation. The first experiment we did is we injected a constitutive active version of myosin phosphatase specifically within the YSL. This led to a reduction of actomyosin accumulation that had been demonstrated before. The ring formation was affected. But then interestingly, if you looked at SO1 subcellular distribution, then we saw that the accumulation of SO1, which you typically see at the leading edge, was diminished, and quite strongly diminished. So once you're interfering with actomyosin accumulation, you do interfere with SO1 accumulation. You can do the reverse experiment, and what we did here is we injected a constitutive active version of RhoA, again specifically within the YSL. This leads to a higher accumulation of actomyosin. It's unfortunately not a very nice picture here, but that has been quantified multiple times. And what we then see is that the accumulation of SO proteins in SO1 is being increased. So reduction of actomyosin leads to reduction of SO1, and an increase of actomyosin conductivity accumulation leads to more SO1 accumulation at the EVL YSL boundary. Now, the mechanism how that is regulated is really what we wanted them to understand, and we came back to these original observations that we are seeing that there's retrograde flow of actin and myosin, and I'll just show you that once more. And here we are seeing myosin, this is actin, and they're flowing together. And we were wondering if perhaps SO proteins and SETO1B in particular would undergo these flows as well, because if you look back in these original, you can see there is accumulation of SO right at the junction. And there's also a non-junctional pool of SO1, which is sitting within the YSL. And we were wondering if this non-junctional pool might actually be potentially transported by these retrograde flows of actomyosin. And that might then indicate a mechanosensitive process where the amount of tension of actomyosin and flow of actomyosin translates into transport of SO proteins back to the junction and could then lead to scaling between junction formation and actomyosin contraction. Now here, this is one example where we're looking at, and I hope you can see that on the screen here, where we're looking at SO1B. And SO1B flows backwards, has this really good flow, pretty much exactly than the flow we typically find for actinomycin. I think the quantification shown here, where we're looking at myosin flows, and you're comparing that to SO1B non-junctional cluster flows, you can see here. And as you can see from the slope and the quantification of that, they flow approximately at the same velocity, 2.5 micrometer per minute, I think. That's what we typically see, 2.2 here. And so that indicates that there's some correlation between the flow of the actinomycin cytoskeleton and the flow of these non-junctional SO1 clusters.
So does the size of the SO1 clusters depend on the expression level? Because you are already expressing.
I'm coming to that. I hope I have the... I'm coming to that. I think we have the contrary. The first thing we want to know is if there's any co-localization between the actinomycin cytoskeleton and SO proteins. And there's a partial co-localization between them. They are not perfectly co-localized. And here we are comparing myosin 2 and SO1B. We're looking at co-localization between these two things. The problem is that you cannot easily look at the relevant actin cytoskeleton because there's a lot of actin at the surface of the plasma membrane, which is associated to endocytosis. And if you're looking at the relevant cytoskeleton of actin, is a little bit more difficult. So what we had to do is here, looking at the co-localization between myosin and SO1B, we see a partial co-localization indicating that there might be some interaction between SO1B and the actin cytoskeleton. What we then wanted to know is if this retrograde flow of SO1 clusters would lead to incorporation of these clusters into the junctional complexes here. And this is just one example where you see it nicely in the chymograph. This is time and this is position along the posterior axis of the anterior axis of the oocyte. But you can see that these clusters flow backwards and then are being eventually incorporated into the junctional complexes, indicating that the flow can indeed translate into accumulation of SO proteins at junctional complexes. If you think about SO1 clusters accumulating on aggregates or clusters within the YSL, you might think that this could be something could have something to do with phase separation. And there was, since this is something everyone thinks about, we thought we need to look a little bit closer into it. And what we wanted to see is if these clusters are spherical, round, droplet-like, what you would assume if it would be a phase-separated entity, and if these clusters can fuse. And what we find is that these clusters are actually not round, and they are not really droplet-like. But they can fuse. But this fusion could simply be a secondary consequence of the actinomycin cytoskeleton contracting and pulling these things together. So this is actually very bad evidence that this could be a phase separation here.
Possibly I've missed it, but do you expect that SO1 is associated with the membrane when it's away from the EVM cells?
Yeah, so again, this is something I show in a little bit more detail, but typically the SO1 clusters are right there where the actinomycin cortex is formed, below the plasma membrane, within the YSL. So there's a co-localization also along the C-axis of the YSL. But I show you a few cross-sections to show that. This just sort of told us that this actually didn't provide any evidence that there is phase separation going on. But Connie, who the PhD student who did all this work, was still believing that this could be phase separation, so she went on. And the next experiment she did is she wanted to see if turnover of SO1 in these non-junctional clusters is very fast, because in phase-separated clusters, turnover is typically very, very fast. And what she did is she did FRAP experiments, looking here at different stages during epiphyly, and she FRAPped a region within the YSL where these clusters are typically localized. And then she was looking at the recovery, and you can see that the mobile fraction is quite high at early stages, and it goes down at later stages, indicating that there's some sort of cluster maturation process where you have a very high turnover initially, and then you have a slower turnover at later stages. Again, this is not really a very strong proof that there's any phase separation. It just tells you that it turns over quickly in these aggregates, but the aggregates could still form by anything different from phase separation. She also looked at turnover of proteins, SO proteins, SO1B protein within the junction, and this is much more stable, so the mobile pool is much smaller, it's 37 degrees, and there's no real maturation process during the course of epiphyry. So once the SO proteins are within the junctional complex, within the junctional pool, the turnover becomes much slower. Coming back to the concentration, this again would be she didn't give up really, and the idea that this might be phase separation, but what she did is she put in different concentrations of SOBAN protein by injecting different amounts of RNA and then quantifying how much SOBAN V is being expressed. What she finds that there is that the concentration scales with the average area size of these aggregates. That's a little bit more in line with the idea that if you have higher concentration, the cluster size becomes bigger. Again, this is not really a final proof for it. What she then did is she looked at different versions of SOBAN-B where she takes out different domains of the SO protein. And the first domain she took out is the actin binding region, because she thought that actin binding might have an effect on the cluster shape, size, and presumably on the formation of these clusters as well. And when she did that, generated a maternocigotic mutant SO1B3 mutant in which she substituted essentially the endogenous version with this version which lacks the actin binding region here. And then she looked how this distributes. This is now the wild-type control where you can see that these clusters are forming, they're occasionally fusing, they are not really droplet-like and they're flowing back towards the junction. If you look at the version which lacks the actin binding, you can see that looks quite different. And these clusters are actually, in average, smaller. But if you look at the circularity of these clusters, they're becoming more circular. So that sort of, you know, was at least consistent with the idea that there might be phase separation, because, you know, once you're interfering with actin binding and interaction between the actin cytoskeleton and these clusters, the clusters become a little bit more droplet-like. Now, the experiment which then finally convinced me is an experiment where she disassembled the optimizing cytoskeleton completely within the YSL by treating embryos with latrunculin. And again, in the control, you see these clusters not droplet-like, you know, occasionally fusing and net flowing backwards. But if you get rid of the actin cytoskeleton, then you're ending up with something which looks much better. And here you have real droplets. These droplets are fusing. There's no actinomyosin in between anymore. So the fusion is not driven by actinomyosin contraction anymore. It's very large. They're quite circular, spherical. So that's a much better evidence that perhaps, to be careful, what we can conclude is that SO proteins can, in principle, undergo phase separation within the YSL. And that association to the actin cytoskeleton changes the size of these clusters, makes them smaller, and the shape of these clusters, make them more regular and less spherical. This is again consistent with other studies which have been done on phase-separated protein entities, and which have shown that wetting of these droplets on actin filaments can change their shape and can change their size. So I think that's at least consistent with what people have previously done on these clusters, on phase-separated clusters.
Do you know how far you are from the endogenous concentration? So if you were to plot or something?
When we express them, we are not far off. So if you're comparing the endogenous expression and the exogenous, once we are putting it into a mutant, I think we are not far off the concentrations. I think she did Western blots to compare these things. I think that's essentially what I wanted to tell you about the phase separation. But really then what's important to understand is if this phase separation behavior and then the backward flow is responsible for mechanical sensation, this accumulation of. What she did is she quantified only the amount of tight junction components right at the EDL YSL boundary, so not this non-junctional pool. She only looked at the junctional pool. She wanted to know if the concentration of SO1 proteins right at the junction scales with actomyosin conductivity within the YSL, which, you know, we found before if you take the full-length version of SO1B. This is what the control situation. What we are doing is we are increasing actomyosin conductivity by injecting a constitutive active version of OA within the YSL, and you get you get this backward flow, this increased flow, backward flow of non-junctional SO1B, and the junctional concentration of SO1B increases in this case, indicating that the amount of SO1B within the junction is increased once you have more actomyosin flow and contraction. Now what she can do is she can take another construct where she just takes off the entire C-terminus, and we knew before and from interaction with Alf-Honigmann flap in Dresden that this version of SO1B cannot undergo phase separation. And this is predominantly due to this U6 domain folding back, inhibiting other domains which are required for phase separation. Now, in this case, you don't have a non-junctional pool because you're not this deleted version is unable to form to undergo phase separation, and Meccano sensitivity of this junctional pool is lost. So you don't there's no more SO1 in response to increase of actinomizing conductivity. Likewise, if you're taking now the version of SO1B which only lacks the actin binding region, you see again that the amount of SO1B in the junction is not scaling again with actinomizing conductivity. What we thought, as an explanation for that, is that presumably these clusters cannot bind to actin anymore, and if they are not binding to actin anymore, then they cannot flow together with the actinomizing surface, and they're not being effectively transported to the junction, and that's why we see this lack of mechanosensation here. Unfortunately, when we worked on the revision of the manuscript, we realized, and I think I didn't put the slide in, but we realized if you look at the flow velocity of the version which lacks the actin binding region, that it actually flows exactly at the same velocity as the wild-type version. So the flow is not dependent on direct binding of SO1 to the actin cytoskeleton, the flow velocity. But interestingly, what we then noted, because we needed to understand why this mechanosensation was lost, we noted that these clusters once you're using this actin binding deficient version of SO1B, these clusters are flowing backwards. They're flowing into the junction, appear to flow into the junction, but then they are sort of flowing behind the junction into the internal YSL. So they are not trapped in the junction, they are not being stably incorporated in the junction, but they are sort of going through the junction, apparently through the junction, and then sort of behind the junction into the internal YSL. I hope the anatomy is clear. You have a junction, the YSL is continuous, you have the external YSL on the outside, and then the internal YSL on the inside. This is all the yolk cell. And these clusters are flowing within the internal YSL, usually to the junction, and then they're being incorporated in the junction. But they're not just going through and then sort of flow on that side. Now, we want to know why that is happening. I mean, this could perfectly explain why this is not mechanosensitive, because these things are not accumulating, really. They're not being stably accumulating. So what we did is we looked here at C-sections. Now, this would be the surface of the YSL. This is outside. This is inside. This is now looking in the yolk cell. This is a junctional complex. And typically what you see is if you look at these SO1B wild-type full-length clusters, they're quite confined to the surface of the YSL where the actinomizing cortex is. And if you follow these clusters, then they're being, they flow right into the junction complex and they're being incorporated in this junction complex. You can quantify the distribution of that. But if you look now at the version which cannot directly bind to actin anymore, then the distribution is quite different along the C-axis of the YSL. You can see that here quite clearly. They're not confined to the surface area anymore where the plasma membrane and the cortex is, but they're distributed all along the width and the depth of the YSL. And quite often you have these clusters which are quite deep within the YSL, flowing backwards and then sort of just bypassing the junctional complex and flowing on. See here, example. So what actin binding is really required is not for the flow velocity, but for confining these clusters right to the cortical area where the junctional complexes are located, and then allowing these things to flow right into the junction and not below the junctions and out again. I think that was important to clarify what actin is actually doing in this process. Yeah?
Then what is regulating the flow of these values to, because it seems to be a directed flow,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. The short answer is we don't know, and the most likely explanation would be this is just a process, achieved by epection, right? I mean, you generate a flow of cytoplasm within the YSL, it's very thin, you have actinomizing flowing backwards, we can just transport it without directly binding to actin. If that isn't the mechanism, we don't know, because formally it's still possible that even the actin binding region deficient version binds indirectly to the actin cytoskeleton via. It has a binding domain for actinin, for example, so it could still bind to actin to some degree, so we cannot completely exclude that this is only action, but direct binding to actin leads at least to redistribution of these clusters and a different subcellular distribution of these clusters within the YSL.
So CP, yes. The deeper clusters, could any of them be endosomes?
None of them has a membrane surrounding it. I think they are all
Membraneless,
and I call them phase-separated entities for reasons that we see these droplets in the absence of actinomizing. Okay, so finally, what we needed to know, and I'm very happy to discuss that because this can be interpreted in various ways. We wanted to know if we are interfering with the mechanical sensation process, would that actually affect epiphyseal movements? Is there any functional relevance of this whole thing here? And the experiment we did here is we tried to rescue the mutant now with the different versions of SO1B we have shown to be insensitive to mechanical stimuli. And in particular, we used the former SO1B, which lacks the C-terminus, the entire C-terminus, and the other one, which lacks the actin binding region. And if we look at the control, this is, standardized to 1. And then if you're looking at the Morpholino, YSL Morpholino, you can see that the whole thing takes a bit longer. And then if you're putting back the full-length version plus SO3, because this is another mutant, we can rescue it to a certain degree. But if you're putting back the truncated version, then the rescue is not effective anymore. And likewise here, if you you can rescue it with the full-length version, but once you're putting back the version which has the actin binding region, it's not effective. The referees of our paper are interested, of course, to know. I mean, the argument is you rescue with a mutant form of SO1B, which is anyway not biological function, so what do you learn about? Sort of a chicken and egg problem, I guess. I mean, we argue that this is not functional, but it's specifically for the mechanosensation function. And, there's no reason to believe that the C-terminus has any other function yet. From other studies in cell culture, you can generate these deletion constructs, and they are still functional. If you take away the C-terminus, if you're taking away the actin binding region, for things which apparently don't involve flows, it seems to be fine for the barrier function of tight junctions. These deletion constructs all work. So I think what we perhaps can conclude to be a little bit more careful is that there's a coincidence of the loss of mechanosensation and the lack of rescuability. If the mechanosensation is the only reason why these constructs are unable to rescue is not clear, but it's likely to, the most likely explanation is probably the mechanosensation at the moment.
So these mutants fail, and you have these embryos which you use to argue that the constriction is not necessary. So if you use this mutant in that, does it actually fail to make it over the...
Yeah, I think that we have not tried that. I think it would be interesting to challenge them a little bit more and, involve the flow friction motor more than the cable constriction motor. I think that's a nice experiment. I think that would be a good experiment to see, to get it perhaps a little bit more severe or something like that. Yeah. Okay, so what we conclude on this part of the work, and I still have a little bit of time, right? I can go on with something else. So what this is all Cornelia, what she did is she showed that tight junctions affect the formation of the actomyosin ring-like structure. There's clearly a feedback loop of actomyosin on tight junction formation. And this is flow and tension dependent, and relies on the ability of SO1B to undergo phase separation. Now, adhesion receptors, tight junction adhesion receptors, do not form a non-junctional pool. They are exclusively localized in the junctional pool. There's no evidence that any of these adhesion receptors actually co-localizes with these non-junctional clusters of SO1B. But if you look at other adapter proteins like singuline, for example, which have been involved in tight junctions as well, then they do co-localize with SO1B. So it seems to be that the adapter proteins of tight junction complexes form these non-junctional clusters via the adhesion receptors. And, I mean, that's all based on what we could test, some occludins and some of the claudins do not localize in these clusters. Perhaps I should just explain why this is actually sort of a meaningful feedback loop. It could explain why this actomyosin ring is forming in the first place. Because, something has to trigger this actomyosin ring formation. That's something which we were wondering anyway. It could simply be that, you accumulate some of these tight junction components here, and then they activate actomyosin, and then actomyosin, then you trigger this feedback loop, and then you can lead to the pronounced accumulation of this actomyosin at the interface where EVL and BSL are making a contact. And this could actually then trigger the formation of this actomyosin cable.
So CP, just to clarify that point,
yep.
When you knock down zeros,
yep.
And quantify myosin,
yep.
Was Cornelia quantifying the extra junctional pool of myosin as well, or was she focusing on the junction? So I guess what I'm asking is whether they're creating a contractile zone.
Yeah, so I think there is one slide in there which looked at the distribution of actin, myosin. that. I think that none of this one. So you're talking about the mutant and myosin, right?
Yeah.
This is what you see. This is the distribution of myosin.
Yeah.
But you see that myosin, this is the position of the junction. You have most of the myosin right in the junction, and then you have this gradient of myosin which goes out from the junction into the bicyanide. And this is what you see essentially in a mutant for 1B and 3. The amount within the junction is being reduced, and there's presumably, but that's perhaps less clear, the distribution within the bicyanide. I think that doesn't seem to be much reduced here, but the junction localization is reduced.
And the flow velocity in cells is altered.
Yeah. The flow velocity, we did that as well. I mean, that's on the side, yeah.
So, CB, can I return to the phase separation idea? Because I'm not quite sure I understand. So is the conclusion that phase separation happens in the mutant where you're unable to bind actin, and the binding of actin suppresses phase separation aggregation?
Yeah. So what we would argue is that phase separation leads to the formation of more droplet-like clusters which are larger in the absence of actin compared to the presence of actin. So it could be that these droplets are wetting on the actin filaments. And this inhibits, this reduces the size of these and changes the shape of them.
So it's sort of interesting. There's some kind of parallel there with sort of stress granule formation, or perhaps the aggregates you see in ALS and so on. So do you know anything about the composition of those aggregates beyond Z01?
Yeah, I mean, what we did is then, there was the obvious sort of task we had to do is we had to look at other components of tight junctions predominantly, and what I mentioned already, we see singling going in there, but we don't see any of the adhesion receptors going in there.
But apart from tight junction components, is there anything else in?
I mean, yeah, we don't know. We have, anything else is a little bit difficult.
Yeah,
you have
to
search for something you think is likely to be in there. Perhaps, that might be interesting. If you treat these embryos with latrunculine, you get rid of the actomyosin cytoskeleton nearly entirely, except right in these big droplets. In the big droplets, you still have actin, some very short filaments of actin and myosin still localizing. So latrunculine is effective to take away the actomyosin cytoskeleton, except the position where these big droplets are formed. But what else is in there?
So, I don't know if you'll get there, but when you look at the membrane, so is O1 going to a tight junction membrane protein, or is it going to a desmosome, or where is it going?
So you're asking where SO1 is localizing in the junctional pool or in the...
So the membrane. So there is a membrane pool, right, at the forefront?
There's a pool right at the junction where the EBL makes contact with the YSL.
So is that a tight junction, a desmosome, what is it?
On EM, it looks like a tight junction, not like a desmosome, but in the meantime, we know that there's keratins actually in the external YSL. So it could be that they are... But on EM, I think from all that we have seen, there's no typical, between EBL cells and boundaries, between EBL cells, you have desmosomal junction. That's very clear. You see keratin, fibers. On this boundary, there's no immune EM, it's just EM. It appears to be more consistent with the idea that this is tight junction, not desmosomes.
Zo1 also binds to integrins, right? And it localizes at lamellipodia, or migrating cells in globulates. And there's a whole field in cancer about how Zo1 binds to integrin and regulates invasion and metastasis. So there's no matrix here, I assume, as well. Or there is. Because it looks like exactly like a lamellipodia undergoing retrograde flow with these clusters of Zo1.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it could be a complete parallel.
Okay, so the embryo is not surrounded by any sort of matrix, right? I mean, that's clear. So if you're looking at the external YSL, there's a plasma membrane, but there's fluid above the plasma membrane. There's no, right at the, where you see these phase-separated clusters, there's no extracellular matrix. Internally, you have extracellular matrix. It's not really accumulated. Integrin expression, we have not looked within the YSL, and we have not looked at colocalization. It would be interesting to see if any integrins would colocalize with these phase-separated clusters. No evidence, but not tested yet. Okay, I think I should move on, and I have a second story if you have enough time. Yeah, I can try. Okay. And you can stop me anytime. You know, how long is it usually? 1 hour or one?
Yeah, 45 minutes.
Okay, oh, that's fantastic. Okay, so the other thing I thought I could speak about, if that is interesting, is the segregation behavior, which I showed you before, where you now you're looking really at only one cell, which might be convenient. And what we see here is initially, before the segregation process begins, there's already some initial accumulation of oroplasm up at the animal pool. And the blue things are the York rhinos. And then you see sort of oroplasm apparently randomly distributed, but it's not completely randomly distributed between these York rhinos. And then the process starts, and what you see is streaming, and the oroplasm goes up and ends up all there. And the streaming seems to be correlated or coinciding with these cleavages. And then eventually you end up with a situation where you have effectively all the oroplasm transported up there, where the embryo is forming, and then you have the food supply on the other side, which is exembryonic and doesn't form, doesn't contribute to the embryo proper.
What are you labeling with?
In this case, I think we injected a rhodamine in the oroplasm, and it could be that we labeled the York rhinos with, we have a version of RAC, which specifically localizes the surface of these York rhinos, and could be that this is RAC adaptation on this picture here, what it was. I think Nile rat also stains York rhinos. But I would have to look back and see what exactly staining was here. Here it's clear what the staining is. What we did here is we wanted to quantify these movements. And again, this process of, we are not the first ones looking at that. And that has been looked for, I think, 30 years already. What we wanted to do is we just wanted to sort of quantify the process first before we go into the mechanism, how that could be achieved. And what we did here is we stained the York rhinos, and the York rhinos we did by looking at RAC localization on York rhinos, I think, and the flow of the oroplasm we visualized putting fluorescent beads into the oocyte and then tracking the beads as a readout of flow of oroplasm. When you look at these flows, what you can see is that the oroplasm, that the flow is it's oscillatory. You can see that there's a little bit of backflow, then it flows up. Then there's a little bit of backflow, it flows up again. We're looking here at the green at the oroplasm as it flows up. Interestingly, if you look at the marginal York rhinos, which are these things here, and these are the York rhinos which are more on the margin, they are actually anticyclic, so they move in the opposite direction. As once the oroplasm moves upwards, the York rhinos in the margin move downwards. And the central York rhinos behave very similar to the oroplasm. And these are the York rhinos right in the center here. They behave similar to the oroplasm. So there's a central flow, predominantly central flow of oroplasm upwards, take some of the York rhinos upwards here, and at the same time, and this is probably a volume conservation, the York rhinos on the margin move downwards, right? And the whole thing is oscillatory, and this is just a schematic diagram of what is happening here. You have these flows of oroplasm together with York rhinos upwards in the middle, and then the rhinos on the side are moving the opposite direction downwards. This again, is mainly, and this has been looked at and described before, and we just sort of repeated that. There had been a model out for many years, again, nearly 30 years now, which sort of explained how this thing might function. It's intuitively a sort of a reasonable model. And what they observed is that if you look at the accumulation of cortical actomycin, then cortical actomycin disassembles at the animal pool. And this disassembly of the animal leads to a deformation, and this deformation leads to flow and accumulation of oroplasm up at the animal pool. So it could be that what you do is you form essentially a bleb-like protrusion by disassembling actomycin, and this bleb-like protrusion leads to flow of oroplasm into the protrusion, and this could partially explain why you get the segregation. And in fact, we looked at the localization of actomycin, cortical actomycin. We see this. It's very clear. You see this reduction of cortical actomycin up here. You see the deformation. You see the flows. It all makes sense in principle. Up to the point when Cheyenne, he's a PhD student, a physicist, did one experiment he didn't really want to do, and that is he put the oocyte into a box and he pushed a little too hard on it, and essentially it exploded. And so he ended up with a soup of Yorkrun, is an O-plasm. There's no plasma membrane, there's no cortical, there's no intact cortical actomyosin cytoskeleton anymore. So you would assume if the model is right, then there shouldn't be much of segregation going on. But in fact, the segregation is actually perfectly fine. You can see that the O-plasm flows up, the Yorkrun is going down. It happens roughly the same efficiency as you see it in the O-plasm. You can do a slightly, let's say, more physiological experiment by simply putting the intact oocyte into this box, and this was the original intention of the experiment, to avoid, to inhibit the spatial deformation at the animal pool, right? This bleb-like formation, you get exactly the same. So that sort of ruled out that that this specific regulation of the actomyosin cortex at the animal pool and this bleb-like formation of this protrusion is actually the triggering process which leads to the segregation. It's simply the self-organizing system where Yorkrun is interact with the oocyte. And this just...
Is there still the cell, the pulp, what's happened to it?
A cell? No, you see a little bit of, you know, you always have in these, when we start to look at the process, you have already a little bit of an accumulation of O-plasm up at the animal pool. This is the former animal pool before the embryo exploded. And it just, you know, it's already segregated to a certain degree. And this is important because it gives the polarity to the whole system.
Sorry, so you took the yolk, you put it in the box, and you press, and it kind of breaks a little bit, but... Have you tried actually really mixing everything and see what
I think he did it, and it was inconclusive. So he pipetted out from the oocyte. He took the Yorkrun plus the ooplasm. The problem I think he encountered is that typically if you take it out, the fraction of ooplasm is relatively small compared to the fraction of Yorkrun, because you don't get the one which has already segregated up there. And then the process was not as clear. There's some segregation happening. But the complete random mixing, it would be a nice experiment to show that this is really entirely self-organizing. I don't think that he did with conclusive results. Now this is just showing you that this is not just one movie. You can see that in the confined case where he just confines the oocyte and it cannot deform at the animal pool, and the cortex free where he destroyed it, he still gets this oscillatory movement of the ooplasm up to the animal pool. Roughly at the same frequency, but at a smaller amplitude. Now the question is then, what triggers this segregation process? And what he noted is, first by just looking at these cortex-free or cortex-broken oocytes, what he noted is that there's a wave of bulk actomyosin polymerization, which is triggered at one point, and then it sweeps through the image here and moves Yorkrun and leads essentially and coincides with the segregation of O-plasm and Yorkrun. So there are waves of actomyosin which come at a certain frequency, and once they're moving through O-plasm and Yorkrun, they trigger, or they might be involved in the segregation. You can see it nicely in the intact embryo. This is where the nucleus is. You see this wave being initiated right where the nucleus is, sweeping through the oocyte from the animal pole down to the natural pole. And during the sweeping process, you trigger the flows, and you trigger the segregation process. Okay, so what he did is he looked at the movement of generation of this actomyosin wave, and this is again oscillatory. And you can see that you can do it in this cortex-free embryos and the destroyed oocytes, and you can do it in the intact embryo. And you get this oscillatory polymerization wave which travels through the oocyte from the animal down to the vegetable pool. You probably, you know, already thought so, that this wave frequency is determined by the cleavage pattern and the cleavage oscillator, and perhaps Stefano was talking about that to a certain degree, CDK1 waves, so you've heard about it. And very shortly, what we believe here is that this is actually this bulk actin polymerization wave is triggered by a CDK1 wave. And the CDK1 wave, again, is triggered by the cell cycle oscillator, and that has been worked out by Tony Tsai in Xenopus. And what we did is experiments where we interfere with the cell cycle oscillator in different ways. We can slow it down by CHK1, and we can speed it up, the frequency of this oscillator, by inhibiting V1. And if you do these experiments, you can not only change the frequency of the cleavage pattern, as has been demonstrated before. But you can also change the frequency of the generation of this actinomizing bicactinolatin base, indicating that this is coupled and that the oscillator, the frequency of the oscillator probably sets the frequency as a CDK1 wave, which is the trigger wave. And the trigger wave then triggers the bulk actin polymerization wave. Now, what we then did is we looked at the, what we wanted to see is we wanted to see if this wave leads to redistribution of actin within the oocyte, and you know how this redistribution of actin within the oocyte could then trigger the segregation pulse. And what we realized is that prior to the actin wave, there's a certain accumulation already of actin at the animal pool. And once this wave has swept through the oocyte, this polarized distribution of actin along the animal vegetal axis of the oocyte becomes more pronounced. So what you do is you polarize actin within the oocyte. And what then happens, and this is not too surprising, if you have more actin up there and less actin down there, you get flows of actomycin which go from the vegetal pole upwards to the animal pole. Okay? And this is quite notable here for having actin. This is utrophin GFP, I believe so. And here we're looking at myosin. You can see for myosin as well that these retrograde flows of actin and myosin from the vegetal pole up to the animal pole. So these flows could explain a lot, because they could, in principle, take along the ooplasm if they would couple to the ooplasm more than to the yolk rhinus, and that could trigger then the segregation process where you end up with the ooplasm up and the yolk rhinus on the other side. So to understand that a little better, we teamed up with Eduard Hanesso, who is a group leader at IST, and we thought about models where we can conceptualize what is happening here. And we ended up with one model where we have three-component system, where we look at the yolk rhinus, ooplasm, and the actomyosin cytoskeleton. And the assumption is that friction between the actomyosin cytoskeleton and ooplasm is higher than friction between the actomyosin cytoskeleton and the yolk rhinus.
This depends. Are you allowing any surface tension between the two phases? Is that at all relevant?
You talk about surface tension between the yolk rhinus, and that's something I don't think it went into the model at all. I think it's all about friction between these components.
And do these things appear to fuse like oil and, you know, separate like oil and vinegar? Do you just look at them?
The yolk rhinus and the ooplasm are certainly not intermixing, and the actinomycin cytoskeleton is distinct from the ooplasm and the yolk rhinus as well. So if you assume that, so what goes in the friction between these between actomyosin and the yolk rhinus and the actomyosin and the ooplasm is the mesh size of the actin cytoskeleton, the mesh size of the yolk rhinus, and the viscosity of these components. And you can measure the viscosity by doing aspiration experiments. We measured the viscosity of the yolk rhinus, of the ooplasm, and then we took known literature about the mesh size of the actin cytoskeleton, and we determined the mesh size of the yolk rhinus. And then indeed, you end up confirming the base assumption that the friction between the yolk rhinus and the actomyosin cytoskeleton is smaller than the friction between the ooplasm and the actomyosin cytoskeleton. If you take that, then you can put these differences in friction in a phase diagram here. And if friction is the opposite way, that the actomyosin would now the friction between the yolk rhinus and the actomyosin would be higher than between the actomyosin and the ooplasm, then you would get the opposite segregation, that all the yolk rhinus are flowing up, and this is the regime where it's actually happening, where the friction is higher between actomyosin and ooplasm, and then you're ending up with all the ooplasm up. So this is all prediction from theory. Then you can do some quantitative comparison between predictions from theory and experiments. So these are two simulations. In one simulation, we were looking at the flow speed of actomyosin as a function of the distribution of actin within the oocyte, right? And in this case, we assumed that we have two regimes of different contractility and myosin-2 activity. If we just lower myosin-2 activity and then look at the flow profile again. These are two things you can do experimentally. You can look at the distribution of actin, or the influence of the distribution of actin on the flow profile, and that matches quantitatively what we're seeing here. And you can reduce myosin activity within the oocyte by expressing considerably active myosin phosphatase. And again, you see that the flow is being reduced. Perhaps it's not too surprising, but you know, it's sort of, I think it was a plausibility test that this theory could in principle explain what we are seeing here. Yep.
So this argues that there is only friction, but there is no binding from acting to Yoder angles.
Yeah.
So do you know that? Do you have an idea if it's binding or not?
We don't see any sort of association of actin to the Yoder angles. But I come to something which is slightly different. Perhaps at the end we can talk about it once more. But there is some interaction between actin and the Yoder angles, which I come at the end. But for the bulk actin in cytoskeleton, which sweeps through the polymerization, there's no filaments being attached to the Yoder angles. Okay. So you can do a little bit more interesting predictions from the theory. One prediction we thought is we can interfere with the actin distribution within the oocyte, and then we could ask how would the segregation work. One prediction is if you get rid of this actin distribution within the oocyte, then the O-plasm will not go to the animal pole anymore, but it would go somewhere in the middle. The segregation process still works, but you get the accumulation in the middle. This is the experiment. What you can do is you can treat again. You use drugs in this case. I think once we are using latrunculine, in the other case we are using just glucuronide down here. In both cases what we are doing is we are changing the polarized distribution, we are reducing the polarized distribution of actin within the oocyte, and then we are asking how would that affect the segregation process. The prediction from the theory is that you get segregation, or the segregation is somewhere within the oocyte. This is animal vegetal, you get it in the... And in fact, it's not as perfect as the simulation would predict, but you see accumulation of O-plasm right in the middle of the oocyte if you interfere with the extent of actin polymerization within the oocyte prior to the segregation process. So that's nice because it sort of confirms that these simulations are completely meaningless in this context. They're quite plausible simulations of the process. Now, there was one problem still which we didn't address and that came out from the simulations as well. If we look at the flow of Yoder angles, and we see that the Yoder angles in the middle are flowing actually upwards together with the ooplasm, while in the margin they're flowing downwards. This leads eventually to some sort of intermixing again. The ooplasm flows up, it takes along some of the Yoder angles, and you don't get perfect segregation of these two things. So what we wanted to know is if there's a way of actually, you can see that the Yoder angles are flowing up, but then before the next sort of flow phase sets in, you appear to push back the Yoder angles now, and then you trigger the next wave of moving up. So there's sort of a period of rectifying this interface between Yoder angles and ooplasm. And that's not something which is explained by the simple theory we used based on the differential friction. So what we wanted to know is how is this rectifying process achieved, and what we noted, and that's quite interesting, is that once this actin polymerization wave hits the Yoder angles, there's polymerization right at the surface of these Yoder angles in a cap comet-like fashion. And actin comet is probably, most of you have heard about it. And so there seems to be if you look at small actin thing, Yoder granules in the animal pool, you can see very nicely this comet formation, and then these granules are being propelled around. So that's quite indicative that what is happening actually here is that the actin polymerization wave, once it hits the Yoder granules in the free surface of these Yoder granules, which is right up to the animal pool, there's where most of the free surface is, it polymerizes, it forms these cap-like structures, this comet-like structures, and by forming this comet-like structure, it pushes the Yoder angles downwards.
So typically, comets will form in vitro. If you were to get some granules collecting up to three.
So
does that happen?
You mean if you're just taking a soup of you see that? You see cap formation, but the segregation process is sort of not very directed. You see pushing, but in various directions. Because the whole thing, the free surface, it can polymerize everywhere, essentially, and this Yoder angle is in a random position, and then you don't get coordinated pushing. Coming back to up to three, it should be Wasp wave up to three dependent. Unfortunately, if we use inhibitors against up to three, we don't see much of an effect. In contrast, if you're using inhibitors for Formin, then the process is being inhibited. So that's the idea that you form these comet-like structures on the Yoder angles, and by forming these comet-like structures on the Yoder angles, you push them and you can rectify this initial interface between Yoder angles, and you can avoid that together with the ooplasm, The York runners are flowing back. Yeah, that's not. Okay.
Just for clarity, the actin assembly, is it polarized? You'd expect it to be polarized in some way. If it is, how so?
Yeah. So what I mentioned before is that when the whole process starts as aggregation, you already have a little bit of ooplasm up in the enema pool, and that creates an interface between the York runners, most of the York runners, and the ooplasm. And this is the interface where most of these actin comet-like structures are polymerizing, because it only polymerizes where there's no contact between York runners, so there has to be a contact-free surface, and then you polymerize it. And so that gives you the polarity of the whole system.
Yeah, so below that, you know, the yolk granules are so dense, right?
Exactly. You get sort of patches of polymerization, but the bulk of the polymerization happens at this interface, and, you know, it just serves to rectify this interface.
Following up on that, the polymerization, at least from what I could see, didn't look really directional. Could you just be increasing the mobility of the granules in the in the top layer, and that would, if you decrease the mobility when they're in the bottom, and then increase their mobility in the top, and then it could be random.
I disagree with your statement that it is not polarized. It is polarized. I mean, we quantify that, and it's clearly
it's polarized.
It's on one side of these York runners. It's right at this interface. Perhaps I can show it once more. I think in this movie, on the left side, it should be particularly clear. Here we're looking at the wave hitting the York runners. You can see it just happens on this.
I was looking at the little ones.
Oh, the little ones on top. Yeah, I mean, they sort of randomly move around, and that's presumably pretty meaningless, because it's just showing that these small droplets, these small York granule things can trigger. That just would increase the. I completely agree with you. Sorry, I didn't.
I'm still trying to look at the comet tails, actually, and I'm failing to see maybe the comet tails. But could it be actually that you polymerize the actin? I mean, the entire interface is moving down. So could it be that you polymerize the actin and you actually fusion granules?
Yeah. I think this is shown, and I didn't say it, but this is, I think, shown. No, I didn't put it. I'm sorry. So what we see is actually once the cap is polymerizing on the York granules, it constricts the York granules, they form, and then you quite often see hatching. So you see this cap forming, it constricts, and then you see the York granules sort of hatching out, and you're left with a shell. And this disappears, and then repolymerizes again in the next cycle and pushes it out. So that's entirely consistent with Cecil Sykes' work, and I think it's quite clear that these are actin comet-like structures, squeezing the York granules and pushing them downwards. Now, what we needed is one genetic, you know, coming back to the, you know, more biological aspect, to interfere with this process to see if it is really required. And luckily, we got hold of a mutant for Daxus and a typical Caterin. And what we realized that in this mutant, the polymerization of actin, this cap formation of actin on this York granules is being absent. And why that is, so we don't know where Daxus is localizing in the early oocyte. But notably, if you look on the left side, I think this is the control, you should see some actin accumulation here. And this is entirely absent in the mutant. Now, so you have a situation where this comet formation is not happening, and then you can very nicely see that these York granules are sort of distributed. You get these ectopic York granules out there at the end of whom you get incomplete segregation once this comet formation is being impaired in the mutant. How Daxus is doing that and where Daxus is localizing, we have no idea. We hoped initially it might localize to York granules, but we don't have a good antibody. There's a transgenic line of a GFP-TEC version, but it just doesn't show anything in the oocyte. So what we ended up is a situation where we have two processes which contribute to the segregation of York granules and ooplasm. One are these flows, these directional flows of actomycin, which take along the ooplasm but not the York granules based on differential friction. And the other process is a rectifying process where, you know, this French press model where you have these actin comets forming at the surface of the York granules and rectify the surface before the next cycle of flow sets in. Okay, should I talk about a third story?
Could you just say a little bit more about the assumption that the friction is different and why that made sense to you?
So what we assumed is that friction, and you know this is all, you know, I'm repeating here what Eduard put in his model. He assumed that friction is determined by the mesh size and the viscosity of the components we're looking at. And if you assume that the mesh size is the dominant factor here, the mesh size of the Ockrian is much bigger than the mesh size of the actomizing cytoskeleton. And that determines then the friction between these components and the difference in friction between the actomizing and the Ockrian is on the one side and the actomizing of the O plasma on the other side. Okay, I should go over that. I can quickly talk about, is that okay if I continue or should I stop? Okay. I can talk about one more story. I keep it short and perhaps, you know, that's interesting because it's about lateral inhibition. And lateral inhibition is probably known to everyone, you know, for all the developmental biologists and cellologists. It's a process where you have, initially you induce an equipotent cluster of cells, which all have the capacity to take on a certain cell fate, which is different from the cell fate surrounding it. And then you single out one dominant cell, and this dominant cell inhibits its neighboring cells and makes sure that this is the only cell which actually forms the cell fate. This lateral inhibition process is typically associated to delta notch signaling, and so you have eventually you're ending up with a situation where the dominant cell expresses more of the ligand delta and activates then notch receptors in the neighboring cells, and then the activation of notch signaling in the neighboring cells suppresses fate specification of the neighboring cells. So that's what, you know, what has been in multiple studies in Drosophila and many other systems shown, that lateral inhibition works very much better. So why did we get interested in lateral inhibition? We looked even a little bit earlier now. We're looking at oogenesis, the generation of the oocyte. And these are different stages of oogenesis in the silverfish embryo. This is taken from, I think, a PhD thesis from someone, I forgot now. And this is just a schematic diagram of what you're seeing here. The volume is massively increasing during these different stages. Interestingly, it's not clear what the time interval is between these different stages, because no one has managed to follow that within the mother. But clearly, there's an increase of the oocyte in volume, and the oocyte is surrounded by a follicular epithelium, like in Drosophila. It's a monolayer epithelial cells, basal to the outside, apical to the inside, facing the oocyte. And interestingly, there's a single cell being specified within these hundreds of cells surrounding the oocyte, and this is the micropylid precursor cell. And the micropylid precursor cell, I'm sorry. And the micropylid precursor cell gives rise to the structure, which is the micropylid. It's a structure of the corium, eventually, so which the sperm finds the entry route to the oocyte and can fertilize the oocyte, and this inhibits polyspermy by just having one point where the sperm can hit the oocyte. Now, this is something you don't need to worry. It's just important because if you don't specify the micropylid precursor cell, you don't form this structure. And if you don't form this structure, the oocytes are infertile and you cannot be fertilized. But we want to know is how do you specify the single cell here? And what we did is we looked at good markers for this cell. And one of the markers which turned out to be highly expressed are keratins. And this is keratin expression. You can see that this is predominantly expressed in this weaning cell, in the one cell which becomes the micropylid precursor cell. And what we also noted is that the micropylid precursor cell massively grows in comparison to the surrounding cells, which are not growing. So that just sort of describes the different stages of micropylid differentiation, but it doesn't tell you how you end up with this one cell here, which is being specified to be the micropylid cell. What we then noted is that not only keratin specifically accumulates in the weaning cell, in this micropylid precursor cell, but there's another factor, which is TAS, YAP-TAS transcription factor. You probably have heard it in the context of hypocycling. And there's a pronounced accumulation of TAS within this micropylid precursor cell, as you can see here, so nuclear TAS accumulates in there. And this TAS nuclear accumulation, I will show you later, is important for micropylid specification. Now, we wanted to see how TAS localizes and how TAS localization is being regulated in this one cell. And what we find is that at very early stages, there's a group of cells which all have elevated levels of TAS in their nucleus. Then eventually one cell is left over which has all the TAS, which gets all the TAS. And then interestingly, you form this shadow of cells surrounding this dominant cell which have reduced levels of tau. So you're ending up in a situation where one cell has loads of tau in the nucleus, then there are 2 to 3 rows of cells surrounding this dominant cell which have hardly any tau in the nucleus, and then you're getting into a regime where cells have sort of a little bit of tau in the nucleus. So that's sort of indicative of a later inhibition process where the winning cell takes it all, takes all tau, and makes sure that the neighboring cells have no tau. So what we did is an experiment where we want to see if this is indeed the process happening, because we cannot follow it in the mother, and we, you know, we can culture them only for a certain period of time. What we did is an experiment where we ablate this already specified cell, and then we're watching if this triggers a re-specification process, right? What you do is you take a UV laser, you ablate the cell is being extruded, you can see it here, and then you're restarting a process which mimics exactly what we thought is actually happening in consecutive steps during neurogenesis. You re-specify a group of cells which has elevated levels of TAS within the nuclei, you have one cell which appears to win, and then eventually you form a little shadow surrounding this winning cell which inhibits the neighboring cells to accumulate TAS. Now this could all be biochemically regulated via notch delta signaling, and that's what we thought initially might be, and there's interaction between notch delta signaling and TAS, the hypersignaling pathway. So what we did is an experiment where we inhibited notch signaling, and what we found to our initial disappointment is that there was very little effect on the specification of the micropipe precursor cell in case where you inhibit notch signaling. So not delta notch signaling, there was not much evidence of delta notch signaling. If you believe in this inhibitor, the delta notch signaling has any sort of important function in this process. So we needed to figure out what this process could, how this lateral inhibition process could be regulated. One thing which we noted and which sort of got us interested is that the micropipe precursor cell massively grows. And this is just the volume of the micropipe precursor cell as a function of follicle diameter, and this is essentially a you know, developmental time during neurogenesis, right? We don't know what the actual time is, we know only the change in the diameter of the follicle. But you can see that during developmental time, there's a very strong increase. This cell just massively grows, and it grows much faster than any neighboring cells does. So what we observe then is, if you assume that, you know, the volume of the whole follicular epithelium is conserved, then you have one cell which is growing faster than the other cell, then you have to compress them eventually. And this is exactly what we see if you're looking at the shape of the cells neighboring this very dominant big cell in the middle, which is the micropipe cell, and they are being deformed. And if you're just looking at the area height ratio, then you can see that the first row is most strongly affected, and then the second row, the third row, and then the fourth, fifth row is not affected anymore. So you have a compression, which presumably is a result of this differential growth of the micropipe precursor cell. So we also wanted to know if this growth and the deformation of the neighboring cells has an influence on tension distribution within the follicular epithelium. What we did is we did cut junctions, and this is all done by Pong Xia, a postdoc in the lab. What he did is he cut junctions oriented radially to the dominant cell here within this neighboring follicular cells, and he looks at recoil velocities, and he does it very close to the cell where we assume that junction tension might be smaller because the cell is compressing the neighboring tissue, and then he did it further away to compare it to see if junction tension would be higher. And this is all oriented radially from this growing cell. And what he finds, this is now this is the recoil velocity in the different rows of cells going from the first row, second row, third row, and so on. And you can see that recoil velocity is smallest directly at the where these cells are being compressed. And then it goes up, indicating that there's presumably some mechanical compression which reduces tension in these junctions, and then tension goes back to normal levels further away from the cell. Now, cellular deformation and tension has been associated with YAP-TAS nuclear localization. This is again, you know, work done by Piccolo and many, many other people, YAP-TAS field. And, you know, what we thought is one way you possibly could exclude TAS from the nucleus of the surrounding cells is by mechanically compressing and deforming them. So there was the idea, and You know, it could be the lateral inhibition process is triggered by some differential growth, which is then amplified by the cell, which grows, gets more TAS, grows faster, deforms the neighboring cells, and neighboring cells by deformation lose TAS from the nucleus, and then you sort of amplify the system. So the idea of that lateral inhibition is mechanically in this case, and it comes from differential growth. So first of all, what we wanted to know is if, you know, for this to work, TAS needs to be meaningful in this process, right? TAS needs to be the decisive factor or one of the decisive factors. So we generate a maternally psychotic TAS mutant. And what turned out is that these oocytes are infertile, indicating that they don't have a micropyle or some other problem. If you look at the micropyle, you see that the micropyle is, you know, often absent or very deformed and very small.
So CP just said, these still got YAP, yes?
So yeah, but the YAP doesn't do anything. We did maternally psychotic YAP mutants, and it's all fine. So YAP has a different function. But it's not differentially localized as much as TAS is. In maternally psychotic YAP mutants, they are fertile. The micropyle is being specified in YAP mutants, but it's not being specified in TAS mutants. Why that is so?
Did you ever look at the double mutant? Is there any difference?
Yeah, we generated a double mutant as well, and that's like the TAS mutant. So what you find is, and this is just important for this lateral inhibition mechanism to make any sense, is that in TAS maternally psychotic TAS mutants, you don't specify the micropyle. Precursor cell, you don't get a micropyle, you don't get fertilization. Now, how can you sort of produce a bit more experimental evidence supporting this assumption? And we did two experiments. One experiment is perhaps not absolutely conclusive. Pong was just ablating the dominant cell, and when he ablates the dominant cell, then he looks at TAS localization, and what he sees is that the neighboring cells gain TAS again in their nucleus. So once, you know, the deformation is being relieved, they are less deformed, and they accumulate at the same time, they accumulate more TAS in their nucleus. But this could still be, in principle, a biochemical factor which is released from the ablated cell, so that's no proof that this is actually compression. But the other experiment was a little bit more direct and what has a little bit more complicated as well. What Pong then did is he took a micropipette and he aspirated this region of the follicular epithelium. And by aspirating and pulling it into the pipette, you relieve the compression. And what you find then, this is the experiment, just, you know, this is a marker for the polarity of the oocyte. He knows where he has to hit the pipette, then he aspirates the surface epithelial cell layer into the pipette, and then he looks at the localization of TAS of the neighboring cells as a result of this relief of mechanical compression from the dominant cell. And he sees what he was hoping to see, that he gets back TAS of the nucleus of these neighboring cells in the first and second row. Okay, I could, in principle, stop here because this is a little bit unrelated.
So CP, does that relief of compression have any effect on the neighboring cells' molecular effect? So do they upregulate keratin 18?
They get more TAS in the nucleus, and I believe they get more keratin, but we cannot wait for another month and see if they all become micropyle cells now. That's just technically not possible. So we don't know if they would, you know, if you would get ectopic specification of micropyle cells. I mean, you see TAS going back in the nucleus. And some keratin, Emily, so.
So let me try to understand more. You initially have a group of cells and have a little bit upregulated or more nuclear organization of TAS.
Yep.
And then they compete with each other, apparently mechanically. And what are they doing? They are growing all of them and they are trying to push on each other, and then at some point isolating mutes.
This is
the neighbors, and that shuts down. Or?
This is exactly what we are seeing, and so you have to assume that there's initially a signal which comes from the animal pool of the oocyte, which specifies a group of cells at the animal pool to become potentially micropyle precursor cells. What we see is that there are 5 to 10 cells which have elevated levels of TAS in their nucleus, and they're becoming motile. And they're pushing against each other, they're quite motile, and then, you know, at the next stage we cannot look for a long period of time. You have one cell which is bigger and the other cells which have lost their TAS in the neighborhood. So there's some sort of competition, pushing initially, and then one cell wins, amplifies its winning capacity and make sure that the neighboring cells are.
And do you know what specifies this group of cells initially that have the upregulated TAS?
What specifies it? What the signal is?
Because it seems to be a region, right?
Yeah.
Do you know what that
region is? So it's presumably a signal which comes from the oocyte and specifies in this region. But what the signal is, we don't know. There are multiple RNAs which are localizing to the ionic pole of the oocyte. I think there have been P's in there. You name them, but we have not systematically really looked at it. The experiment you can do, perhaps, you know, which is a little meaningful, they're mutants for the animal vegetal polarity of the oocyte. They have problems in Balbiani body formation, which is again a phase segregated structure, which is in the vegetal pole. In these mutants, everything is animal. And there you see multiple mycopyl precursor cells being specified in the oocyte, but never directly adjacent to each other. And there's always a minimal distance which spaces these mycopyl precursor cells.
And the one cell that wins is always in the middle of the group?
I'm not sure, really. I don't know. I mean, you know, I think the N is not big enough to really say that. I mean, there are a few. I mean, the only experiment where we can really watch the whole process is in the ablation experiment, where you get re-specification. I'm not sure if you can really systematically say that this is right in the middle, and it doesn't need to be right in the middle. Because, I mean, that propagates 2 to 3 cell diameters out. Yeah. Okay, I could finish here. And I should quickly acknowledge, I need to go back, show you some of the people. Connie did all the phase separation and SOP protein, she's standing here. And Pong, here he is. He did the stuff on the lateral inhibition, and Cheyenne. Where's Cheyenne? Can't find him. He might not be in the picture. Okay, good. Thank you.